The Money Show.
Personal Finance with Warren Ingram.
Personal Finance brought to you by Satrix, investing global funds. Invest with Satrix. Now, Warren Ingram. Lots of confusion this week around how retirement funds can invest. There's something called Regulation 28. We've mentioned it many, many times. Regulation 28 is infamous because in investing circles, you know that it limits the amount of money that can be invested on your behalf offshore. 30%, I think, outside the country, another 10% on African investments outside of South Africa. The balance has to be on the JSE. And it means that because of the shocking performance of the JSE for as long as it has been, most retirement funds have underperformed inflation, certainly dramatically underperformed the global markets over the last 5 years. This week, a bombshell announcement from the Reserve Bank, and it suggests that if you choose to, you can invest 100% of your retirement savings globally, and it gets people terribly excited. Then the Financial Sector Conduct Authority, which regulates pension funds, says, No, not so quickly. We haven't been told about this. We're trying to understand the implications. Is that correct so far? I've tried to summarize it.
That's a very good summary. Yeah, I think the only point of disagreement will be the Reserve Bank's notice actually didn't say anything about pension funds at all. I think that's where, you know, so they talk about institutional investors. And so I'm not to try and sort of nitpick, but I think, retirement funds are a very specific category of investments. And so institutional investors, I think, it's a bit vague in terms of what they mean there, but certainly then they didn't refer to retirement funds in any way, shape or form.
Okay, but they said institutional investors could invest more offshore, and that was then taken by some asset managers to be your retirement savings can go offshore.
Yeah, this is where my soapbox kicks in. I think it almost feels to me like willful misreading of it to get press coverage. You know, this is kind of, it feels to me like PR sabotage. You know, I spoke to a couple of different people in the last day or two who are in this industry, and some of them are the legal experts. And they're saying, one of the people out there was saying, no, we've got legal opinion and, you know, we're absolutely right. We're going to change our retirement fund rules immediately. And the lawyers are saying there's nothing in there that can help you make that conclusion. It's just not possible. And I think the point here is the Reserve Bank controls certain bodies and certainly is responsible for certain parts of our regulations, but they've got absolutely nothing to do with retirement funds. You know, that is the FSCA, and they are the last word on this thing. And until we hear something from them, it's impossible to come to a different conclusion. So I feel this is, these are people that are being opportunistic. They're trying to get on the bandwagon. And this is something that, was actually raised already in October by the finance minister. So, I can understand the regulation, and it's actually a really exciting regulation for totally different reasons. And it's got much more to do with...
Explain what's exciting from this regulation at the Reserve Bank, because I think we're going to get ourselves tied in knots, because this is massively technical stuff. So this, there is something has changed. What has actually changed?
The very short answer for private individuals is assume for now nothing's really changed in a private individual's life. We can send out our 10 million rand a year. We can, and we have always been able to buy rand-denominated overseas investments. So we can buy, they call them, feeder funds, where if it's a unit trust that buys overseas markets, or ETFs that are available on the world market or the US market or whatever. So from that perspective, this doesn't change our lives at all as a private individual. However, this is an attempt by the regulators to make the JSE, the actual stock exchange, much more competitive than it's been in the past. Because at the moment, let's just say a South African company wants to raise funding overseas. They want to borrow, 100 million euros, and the euro interest rate is pretty much zero or negative. So it's very attractive for them to do that. If they wanted to do that today via a bond, the company wanted to issue a bond, they would need to list that bond on another stock exchange overseas, which means that the South African market just gets smaller. Capital is getting funded overseas and raised overseas, South African investors can't benefit from that unless they then go overseas and access those. And that's the big change here. Now, a South African company can list a bond in South Africa on a South African stock exchange, which will be paid back in Rand. So it is Rand denominated, but the basis of it is a euro loan at euro interest rates. So it starts to widen the access to capital, and it's to stop the money flowing out of South Africa. So to me, that's the primary reason that this is happening. And the second thing is we've got all these complex structures based on our history. You know, if you look at something like Richemont, you know, which is, you know, it's listed. Where is it actually listed? And actually, you know, what do you own if you own the South African version? And, you know, look at 91. We've got all these weird structures that come about because of our exchange control history. And this is an attempt to start to clean that up and actually make it easier for companies to raise capital over, you know, in foreign currencies, but do it through the local stock market. So that's the exciting part, actually, not for you and me and, you know, everyone else out there. If the FSCA says something in the future to say, hang on, we're going to increase the offshore allowance of retirement funds, that's a different game.
All right. So there is an exciting development from a Reserve Bank perspective. It does not, at this stage, translate to the way in which my pension money can be invested. And that's so disappointing because I got quite excited at this. Because I'd happily say to the South African government, you know what, you want prescribed assets. You want to use 10% of my retirement savings to invest in projects in South Africa. By all means, the quid pro quo is you then free up the rest of any investments I might have, pension fund investments, to be put anywhere else in the world. Then we've got a deal. I think we've got to start getting a bit more creative than we have been up until now.
Well, and I think that's actually, you know, so in the back of my head, you know, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but I'm wondering if there's a little bit of give and take in this, you know, where they might, you know, might do this as step one, and then say to retirement funds, okay, we would like you to do more infrastructure projects, et cetera, and here is the quid pro quo. But I mean, we can't make a prediction with politicians, but I'm pretty sure that prescribed assets is not on the table. I'm pretty sure we're going to be talking about bankable projects, which is what the retirement fund industry has been asking for all along. And it's going to be one of those situations where the current rules will be clarified, new projects will be put in place in such a way that it's easy for retirement funds to invest in them, because at the moment it's not. And so, you know, it'll become almost on a per project basis rather than this thing of, you know, give all the money to SANRAL and just hope that they do correctly with it, or, you know, in the past SAA or whatever the deal is. Now it's going to be, I'm hoping, you know, we're building a toll road from, you know, Joburg to Bloemfontein, for example. It's already built, I know, but here's a project. We're going to pay you 8% a year for the next 20 years and give you your capital back. If that's the kind of bankable project that they allow retirement funds to invest in, great. Everyone will want to do that because, you know, we know that the toll roads are a great way to make money and, you know, pretty consistent unless you've got COVID. And for retirement funds who can't get a return on cash at the moment, you know, and they're worried about other asset classes like shares, that would be a great deal. So I think, you know, prescribed assets is one of those things that just needs to be put to bed. I wish government would announce something about it and just say it's not on the table. And if they're going to relax exchange control somewhat within the retirement funds, wonderful. And if infrastructure projects is the quid pro quo, I agree with you. I mean, I think we'll all do it. But I don't think it's going to be a case of saying you may now invest 100% of all retirement fund money overseas, because we're talking about trillions of rands. And I just think, you know, the stock exchange here can't take that knock. You know, we need to deepen our capital market.
It makes, and more fortunately, it makes no sense. And there was a moment there where I went, no. Not true. Anyway, I watch and I'm look, there are lots of very clever people who believe this to be true, and there are equally clever people who believe it to not be true. And I hope that the Financial Sector Conduct Authority comes out with a very clear, unequivocal statement very, very soon, because there's a lot of speculation around this. Do talk to me, please, about our listener question this evening. What countries do I buy if I buy an emerging market index? And how much of that emerging market index is South Africa? So that is our question this evening. An emerging market index, it would be a pretty interesting index of, I don't know, Venezuela, there'd be some Brazil.
Come on.
Anyway, what would go into an emerging markets index?
So just the background to this question is it actually came up from a few listeners, because we've spoken about, you know, getting some emerging market exposure on the show before. And so this came up. And so if you buy it now and you look at what it will track, it tracks the MSCI World Emerging Market Index. And 37%, nearly 38% of that is in China. The next biggest country, interestingly, is actually Taiwan, at just under 14%. And then Korea, then India at just under 9%. You're right about Brazil, just under 5%. Then South Africa at 3.6%. So it's not a big constituent of the emerging market index at all. I can't see Venezuela here. I do see Russia at 2.8%, and a bit of Saudi Arabia and Thailand and Mexico and Malaysia, Indonesia. So a very nice big spread. And if you think about the top three, you know, China, Taiwan, South Korea, that's a real tech player in my view, you know, tech and maybe banking to some extent, and countries and sectors that, you know, that are doing extremely well. And so, you know, the fact that we've spoken about this before in the show around emerging markets, and now we understand the geography of this, you know, I'm saying to people, you know, it's a lovely set of geographies to be in. And then the sectors, you know, you're buying basically information technology is the biggest, just under 20%. And then financials are, you know, just under 18%, communication. And then we go down to kind of the mines, because I think in the old days, people would have said, oh, but that's really, you know, you're kind of buying resources, aren't you? And materials only makes up, you know, just under 8%. So I think it's a, you know, very much at the cutting edge of where the world is going and world businesses are going, with a really nice population demographic behind it of, you know, a very young, productive population pushing these companies ahead. So, you're not buying a lot of South Africa. So if you buy the index, you're not doubling up on your exposure to here if you want the diversification. And you're getting, you know, a wide range of industries which we can't really access from South Africa. You know, we just don't have access to these big tech companies that are kind of, you know, the next generation of behemoths after the Americans.
Can I just then add a little bit of complexity? Because I'm on the Satrix website this evening and I see the Satrix MSCI World ETF. That's one you're just referring to. Globally developed diversified ETF includes shares from 23 countries. But then they've got the S&P 500 Satrix, the NASDAQ 100 Satrix, the MSCI China Satrix, and then ESG Enhanced, MSCI Markets, ESG Enhanced, Global Aggregate. Oh my goodness gracious me, and immediately I want to curl up in a ball and suck my thumb, but only after it's been sanitized. We immediately get ourselves into a bit of a tiz, and it comes down to simplicity once again, Warren, and trying to get the broadest possible spread without getting too clever.
My very simple formula for someone who wants to get a good global portfolio and wants a bit of emerging market exposure, I would say you take, you know, out of every 100 Rand that you've got, put 70 Rand into that world index, so the MSCI world, and that literally is what it says. It covers the world markets, but it's much more invested in the developed side of the world, not the emerging market side. And then you take 30% and you put it into the emerging market index. So you are going to get a little bit of overlap, not much, but you're going to get a very nice exposure to the growing part of the world, but both in population and productivity. And then you've still got exposure to the bigger, I almost want to say the old tech companies now, you know, mainly in America. And to me, that's a very nice portfolio. I'm not going to go and choose specifically a China index or, you know, a American index. I think that's overcomplicating it. ESG is something we're going to have to talk about a lot in the future, because that is a growing trend. But for now, that would be the portfolio I'd put together. Very simple. $70 okay. In the world, $30 in emerging markets.
And then a final point on this one is, can we do this then through a, what are they called, tax-free savings account?
You can, and certainly a lot of money, tax-free savings money, has gone into those. So that's kind of a, you know, for me, it's a default, especially for youngsters. You know, if you people who've got, you know, very young children, I always say to them, this is a great portfolio, that 70-30. You know, it's kind of a no-brainer, very low cost. And again, you know, the exchange control news we've all heard about has no impact here. We've been able to do this for ages.
All right, good. We look for tax-free savings accounts around that sort of option. Let's do that. Warren Ingram, thank you very much. I've got a question for you, your word of the week. Now, it's a word or a phrase, because we give you a little bit of leeway. This week, because I think I'll need to challenge, and you'll get this one. But I'll have other questions. What is a government bond? In honor of Sean Connery, there's James Bond, and then there's government bond. I want to know what is a government bond, but I'm going to give you a minute to ponder.
The Money Show.
Personal finance with Warren Ingram.
Then I realize actually it's a very easy question for you. So I don't mean to patronize you by giving you time to think about it, Warren Ingram, but your word, your phrase, government bond, what is it?
I was terrified you were going to ask me to do it in a Sean Connery accent, so I'm glad you gave me a bit of time to prepare, which means I don't have to do it.
Thank goodness. Now, I don't think anybody should be subjected to that.
No, I was a bit shaken. And so a government bond is basically where a government says, we need to borrow money from investors, and we promise to pay you a particular interest rate. So let's just say in the South African context, you know, 8% is kind of a norm around here. So we as government are going to borrow money from you. We're going to borrow 20 billion rand as an example, and we're going to pay you 8% a year on that 20 billion rand every year. At the end of the 20-year period, we're going to give you back your money again. And in structure, that is a government bond. It's actually a very simple instrument to understand. Typically, what will happen is they won't pay you the interest on a monthly basis. They'll pay it twice a year. And they generally trade in quite large amounts. So it's not really that easy for the likes of me, for example, to go and buy that just on my own. It'll be fine for you, Bruce. So you can do the bigger amounts. But for the smaller investor like me...
Why is everybody picking on poor little me this evening? I've got Pavlo telling me I earn more than his mate, LeBron James. You're telling me, no, nonsense.
I'm just a
poor boy from a poor family. Nobody loves me. Scaramouche, scaramouche. Do the fandango. Thunderbolt and lightning. Come on. Yeah, sorry.
You know, that's my song.
It's everybody's song. It should be.
So I think in structure, very simple, and it can be traded. So the bond market's way bigger than the stock market. And I think that's the thing. It's not very spoken about a lot, because it's not as if, the bond suddenly becomes more interesting after it's, after it's being bought, where it's being managed and it can sell more stuff or do more things. It's just a very basic, investment. The only complexity around that is if interest rates in general start to move. So, for example, you buy your government bond at 8%, and then the government says, gee, we're actually dropping interest rates. What that will mean is if you bought the bond, you can actually sell it to someone else at a higher price. So the bond price can move, and it moves because of interest rates. So that's really the complexity of bonds. Other than that, very simple, and not to be confused with RSA retail bonds, which are basically fixed deposits. So that's where people do get confused from time to time.
It's a mechanism for countries to raise money. And I mean, in a world where global interest rates are as low as they are, South African bonds, government bonds, because we are now sub-investment grade across all of the big international ratings agencies, are paying considerably more or higher rates, higher returns than, say, a Norwegian bond, if it ever issued one, or a UK bond or many others in the world, because there is a belief that government may do what Zambia did this week, and that is default, not pay the interest bill.
Well, that's true, but at the same time, you can actually buy insurance against something like that, credit default swap. So a lot of institutions overseas will look at South Africa now, do their calculations, and say, you know what, if we can get a decent yield, even though interest rate, it's not to use jargon, and if we have to pay away 2 or 3% of that interest to get the insurance, it's still a great deal. So a lot of the international funds and international investors will be looking at that. And just to give you an idea, I got a quote the other day. If you wanted to put 100,000 Swiss francs in a Swiss bank at the moment for a couple of years, you would have to pay the Swiss bank 0.75% a year for every year that you've got the money deposited in their bank, and they're going to use it on your behalf. So at the moment, interest rates like ours become incredibly attractive for overseas investors.
Which is precisely why I've not put $100,000 into a Swiss bank account. Thank you, Warren Ingram from Galileo Capital, financial advisor, translator of complex financial concepts for us on a Thursday night. Wrapping up this evening's edition of The Money Show, thank you for listening. Looking forward to being in your company again tomorrow. We've got some fabulous tales to tell, including our Friday files. Somebody doing something incredibly creative for money. Till then, good night.